Committee, Representative Petersburg. We will go ahead and move your bill when we have a quorum, but you can introduce your testifier and your bill. I don't see any amendments, so we can get right into the bill. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. My testifier is Chris Bowman, who will have brief comments later. This is not a complicated bill. This actually deals with intermediate care facilities and the reimbursement rates that are there, and I'm sure this committee is very much familiar with how that works. The bill actually addresses Kaplan Woods Care Home, which is a Class PB facility. Currently, they are the fifth lowest. There are only five in the state that are under $200 a day in reimbursement. And put that in perspective, the highest rate is over $470 a day, more than double the rate that this particular facility gets. Matter of fact, there's a home in Faribault, less than 20 miles away, that's getting $90 a day more than this one. But in reviewing statutes, I found that virtually all of the increases over the last 18 years have been pretty much straightforward across-the-board percentage increases. And what happens when you do a percentage increase across the board is that you make the gap between the top and bottom grow larger and larger and larger. So at some point, I'm sure that there needs to be a way to readjust this into making a little bit more of a equalized reimbursement rates towards equity and fairness, but this bill isn't it. This one is just really dealing with the issue that is that Kaplan Woods Care Facility actually needs to stay viable for the residents that it has. It is a facility that has a capacity of 16 beds and is now currently at 11, and this really is an attempt to keep the home viable for the residents that are there. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd turn it over to my testifier, Chris Bowman.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bowman. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Chris Bowman, I'm honored to be in front of you to present a need on behalf of Kaplan Woods Care Home. Like Representative Petersburg said, we're a Class B facility, one of 118. We're known for taking on very challenging individuals with both behavior and medical issues and helping them make positive progress with both health and behaviors. Excuse me. To put the medical care in context, some residents we have we feed through G-tubes. We manage severe degenerative conditions, severe diabetes, 24/7, 365. Some of our residents are blind, and they have other degenerative conditions in addition to mental health and intellectual challenges. Many of our residents come from other care homes that can no longer take care of them or no longer want to take care of them. I'm here today to ask for a rate increase so we can continue to serve and be the family and community our residents deserve. A couple quick reasons for the rate increase. Cost of care has gone up exponentially. One of the big drivers is skilled nursing. We cannot just have PCA care 24/7. We require a great increase to our skilled nursing care to deal with the complex medical conditions we're serving. Also, paying a living wage. Many of our PCAs were not able to afford to pay a living wage today. So we want to remedy that as well as we're not able to pay any benefits. Also, we have an aging facility that was built in the 70s. There are many codes that we're required to keep up with. We have original boilers and other infrastructure that we need to upgrade to be able to serve our residents. As an example of a recent successful increase, the intermediate care facility last year at Slayton, Minnesota, a few hours from us, had our same reimbursement rate at $188.40, and they got the same rate increase that we are proposing for many of the same reasons. In closing, Mr. Chair and committee members, we do a very difficult job. We're sworn at, verbally abused. We deal with stubbornness, bad behaviors, bad smells, difficult family members, and a mountain of paperwork, really to add to all of that. We do it because everyone needs care. Our residents need love, and they need a life with purpose, and that's what we strive to provide. The best analogy I can give you in closing is that this is not just about the cost of care, but this is a cost of us being a family member to these people. We're not just caring for our residents. We're out in the community with them. When they need to go to the hospital at 1 a.m., we're there. We try to make birthdays, holidays special, and care for them in every aspect of their lives. Mr. Chair and members, I'm exceptionally grateful for your willingness to hear us. I appreciate, on behalf of my entire team, I appreciate your consideration in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman, for your testimony, and we're grateful for the care that you provide Minnesotans in your area. And we do now have a quorum, and Representative Zerwas moves approval of the minutes for April 11th, 2018. Are there any additions, corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The April 11th minutes are adopted. I will officially move House File 4030 be laid over. And Representative Petersburg, do you have any other testifiers?
No.
Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on House File 4030? Seeing none, we'll close off the testimony portion and open up for member questions or comments. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Petersburg, thanks for bringing this bill, and to your testifier, thanks for being here. You know, I just wanted to comment. It's more of a comment, I guess. We, in the Health and Human Services Committee, we, of course, hear about the many, many needs that Minnesotans have. And, you know, I appreciate the testifier, and I don't doubt for a second how difficult it is to take care of the folks that you're taking care of and how hard you work at it. And I have no doubt that you're getting too little money. So I'm not opposing the bill as such. But it's really a systemic problem. And too often in this legislature, we hear complaints about how fast the Health and Human Services budget is growing and that the way to deal with it is to cut the budget. And somebody always finds something to cut that they think, you know, doesn't affect them or doesn't affect things that they, you know, see close up and what those effects are. But I think this bill kind of brings to our attention how real the needs are. That we have a lot of needs in Minnesota, and the population of people with disabilities is growing. People with disabilities are living longer, right? I'm sure the testifier knows that and sees that, and that's a good problem to have. We used to lose people at much earlier ages, and now people with disabilities that we thought were life-threatening at one time now can live quite a long time, but that comes with a cost. And it comes with a cost often to the public. And this is where we see it. I'm just a little bit troubled that we're in this situation where we're having these one-off requests because, and I'm glad for you that you're able to be here and find somebody to carry your bill and come and ask for a request. But it concerns me because Minnesotans shouldn't have to come individually to lobby the legislature to get care for the people that they're serving. And we just hear so often in this committee about the, you know, how low rates are and how, you know, people with disabilities have to spend way down to get medical assistance and on and on and on. So I just wanted to make those comments as we're here, as the chair is going to consider whether he can find the money to fund this bill. Just that this bill, to me, is just illustrative of the need, and it's just a drop in the bucket. But I don't know. I think we should be thinking about this in a more systemic way because you're asking for more than doubling your rate. And I'm sure, and you said, I think that you're, or somebody said you're the fifth lowest. And so there's somebody even lower, and they're not here with a bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I think you really articulated the services that you provide very well. I've actually struggled to try to do that on a couple of occasions. I like the part about being the family for them, and I definitely think your people deserve more money and will support this. I just hope we don't have to have each individual home come in to do this, but yeah, your folks do an amazing amount of work and do it with compassion and care and deserve it. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing no other member questions, Representative Petersburg, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just again appreciate you your consideration. This is a challenge. It's a challenge to deal with a system that as we've heard, could be systemic in nature as well. But in reality, this is the remedy that we have available to us at this time, and I just thank you for your consideration and your support.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. House File 4030 is laid over. Next up, we have House File 3201, Representative Zerwas. Representative Zerwas moves House File 3201 to be laid over. There is no amendment. There is a fiscal note in the packet. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members might recall this from Health and Human Service Reform. House File 3201 was brought to me by the Sherburne County and the Minnesota Inter County Association. The bill addresses county challenges relating to hospitalization criteria for county clients ready to be released from ARTC, but still in need of competency restoration services. Current law requires counties to pay 100% of the cost of care at AMRTC when an individual no longer meets the hospitalization criteria. This bill would modify a county's payment of cost of care so that the county's share for the competency restoration aligns with the existing rates for the needed level of treatment of care, regardless of the facility in which the client is located. If a client does not meet the hospital level of medical necessity and a client's discharge or transfer is delayed because of insufficient competency restoration services. And so where this is coming from, members, is there's been several instances in Sherburne County and in other counties across the state where counties are being notified that an individual at AMRTC no longer meets the hospital-level criteria of need of care, but then they're told, well, we're not ready to release them yet. And 100% of that cost is being shifted to the counties, sometimes for days and then sometimes up to weeks. And for a county like Sherburne County, or it happened last week in Blue Earth County, these costs can be significant. And really catch a county by surprise and make it a very challenging item for a county to try to budget for. That being said, Mr. Chair, members, I have with me today Mary Jo Cobb, Health and Human Service Director at Sherburne County, who can talk about the current process.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Cobb. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Mary Jo Cobb, and I am the Director of Health and Human Services in Sherburne County. I'm here to testify in support of House File 3323 on behalf of Sherburne County and Minnesota Inter-County Association, MICA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, and the Association of Minnesota Counties, AMC. This afternoon, I want to share the reasons why counties support the language changes proposed in this bill. Between Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and the community-based behavioral hospitals, in 2016, counties paid $23.3 million for does-not-meet-criteria days of care. In 2017, that amount was $18.7 million. Counties pay whether or not they have the ability to move the client to another facility, whether notice was received timely, or if there is a bed available. While we are still working on language with DHS, the intent is to address situations when a client does not meet medical necessity and is ready to be released to a competency restoration program, but there are no beds available. These programs are state-operated services, and counties do not have control over where people go and the wait lists. It further addresses situations where a facility deems a person no longer meets medical criteria, but then the person is not immediately discharged due to a delay caused by DHS or the facility. Again, counties are responsible for 100% of the cost when the person doesn't meet medical criteria. At $1,390 per day to $1,465 per day, this adds up very fast. Sherburn County's costs were only a small part of those numbers, but still significant to our county budget. In 2017, Sherburn County had four individuals who remained at Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center when they no longer met medical criteria for hospitalization. In one case, we received a fax on a Saturday that medical necessity had ended. Since no one was working to facilitate a discharge, we paid for Saturday and Sunday. In another case, the agency was notified on a Friday that medical necessity had ended. We offered to move the client that day, but were told by hospital staff that they would not have the discharge paperwork completed until the following week, and we were billed for the extra days. Sherburn County had two other clients who stayed 12 and 37 days after they no longer met criteria for hospitalization, and appropriate placement options were not available to them. These two clients cost the county nearly $100,000. Overall impact on Sherburn County for 2016 was $115,000, and for 2017, the cost was $107,000. But as I stated earlier, statewide, the cost was $23.3 million and $18.7 million. As a representative of MACSA, I can assure you that all counties support this bill. An option to appeal these costs would be very helpful. Counties already use an existing appeals process when we disagree between ourselves on who is financially responsible. A similar appeals process could be used when the counties and the state disagree on who is responsible for payment. We believe that this bill will create more transparency in decision-making and discharge planning for clients. The language that says the commissioner and facility shall partner with the county to find appropriate placement for the client by the discharge date on the notice creates a shared responsibility for the continuing care of persons with mental illness. We are very willing to partner with the commissioner and facilities to make this happen. In summary, we feel that we are addressing a number of DHS concerns, including the removal of the 10-day notice requirement, as well as limiting the wait list information to state-operated services. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Cobb. And next we have Angela Youngerberg. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I'm the Human Services Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, and the Association of Minnesota Counties. I fully agree with the testimony of my colleague, Mary Jo Cobb of Sherburn County. This is a very serious issue for counties as we try to balance care and fiscal responsibility and accountability at a local level. I actually asked to testify today to share a real story from last week. As I knew that this bill was moving through the legislative process, I thought that it was prudent to bring this information to you in as close to real time as possible. Before I begin the story, it's fair to assume that all people involved, including the staff at AMRTC and the county, had very, very good intentions in mind. It was the policies and procedures that were at the root of the issue that allowed us to, that was very difficult to overcome. I'm also here because without a county appeal process, we have no audience to share this information. And so therefore, we have no mechanism to ask for change. In Blue Earth County, we are fortunate because we invested in a specialized case management system to limit the amount of does not meet criteria days at state facilities. To give you an example, last year we projected to spend $320,000 on these does not meet criteria days just for Blue Earth County. We actually spent $80,000. So we changed the way we practiced because we heard loud and clear that we need to do things differently. Even with that, 44% of individuals in those facilities did receive a does not meet criteria process. So I'm here to say I don't believe we can get to a 100%, but on those that do not meet criteria, there are some situations that are well beyond our control. On April 4th, Blue Earth County received a does not meet criteria designation for an individual at AMRTC. Plan A for this individual was to discharge them to a community residential placement on April 11th. That is what we had been planning to do all along. The does not meet criteria designation on April 4th moved up the timeline, so the clock started ticking. Plan B that we made within an hour was we secured a bed at another facility within the same organization that he was to be discharged to, at the same staffing level and the same licensure. They agreed to do an integrated transition plan for the individual. They could take him same day that we received the Does Not Meet Criteria, and they would transition him to the bed on the 11th. They would do an integrated plan with staffing. It was a good plan B. It wasn't great. It was good. AMRTC refused to discharge the individual with this plan, citing that they didn't believe the individual was stable enough to return to the community and successfully sustain two moves. They wanted what was best, not just satisfactory. And they did not have an ability to complete the discharge process within one day at our request. The AMRTC staff also indicated that they would continue to work towards the April 11th discharge date. To shorten the story, because as you can imagine, there was a lot of back and forth that happened at that point, our county staff had no ability to influence the plan. The person was not moving, and we were looking at an $11,120 charge that was likely to be issued to our county. And so I asked, how could this be? Because clinically, he was ready for discharge, but clinically, he was not ready for discharge. And so this clinical disagreement within AMRTC existed, and it was very real. I personally have the fortune of knowing Wade Roast. He's the state's executive director for mental health and substance abuse treatment services. I reached out to him, and he was very responsive to my request. The next day, I received word that AMRTC had agreed to the discharge plan B that we proposed. Today, before I came here, I heard that the individual is doing very well at his final location. I appreciate Mr. Roast's ability to navigate the lines of communication on our behalf, but I do know that not all counties can make a connection like this, nor should counties or top-level hospital leadership. This is not a good long-term solution. Our staff should be able to navigate this process. We desperately need a third-party appeals process to assist and sort this out so that we can keep our focus on the person and not the payment. We are working with DHS staff to iron out the fine details of this bill. As we have been doing so, one consequence that was brought to our attention is that if the county does not pay the cost of care, the person will be charged. That is not our intent or desire at all. Through our research with DHS, we learned that if there is no payer source during the hospitalization, and many do not have one, the client is currently billed for their cost of care for the days that they do meet hospital criteria. The state follows specific administrative rules, and we understand that those state administrative rules currently do not allow a mechanism for the state to bear the costs for these unique situations. If the county does not pay, the client pays. But we contend that it does not have to be that way. We'll continually work with the department on this bill, and this bill makes adjustments to uphold the original intent of the guiding statutes and deals with some of the cracks that have formed as a result. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Youngerberg. And Representative Considine has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Angela. One of the things that strikes me in the testimony is that they are discharging people or saying they don't meet the criteria, but then they don't have the paperwork ready. Shouldn't that be a requirement before they even call you? And I don't understand why... That rationale just throws me, that they would even make that initial call until their paperwork is lined up. Does that happen fairly routinely?
Thank you. I can speak on behalf of Blue Earth County only. I would ask if Mary Jo has an opinion, she can certainly talk about that. We do not, when we do receive a does not meet criteria designation, it does not, is not accompanied by an effective discharge plan from the hospital. So those two things are not one and the same. Oftentimes, from our experience, the clinical staff working with the individual at the hospital, they're notified at the same time that we are that the person doesn't meet criteria. So it's a separate utilization management team in the hospital that determines that. So from a... From a structural standpoint, there's a problem. So I don't think it's that staff don't want to provide that. We have a structural problem.
Follow up? Thank you. Their treatment team isn't part of the discharge team? Is that what I'm understanding?
Ms. Youngerberg.
The treatment team does do the discharge planning, but it is our understanding that they are not the utilization management review team. So it's two separate clinical views is what we've been told.
Follow-up comment? I would think that would be something that would be a fairly reasonable and easy fix for them to communicate with each other a little bit better. Am I missing something?
Ms. Youngerberg.
Yes or no question?
Oh, boy.
What? And Mr. Chair and members, there's a lot of frustration among counties, and I think the challenge is that there seems to be a disconnect between the process to tell counties this person no longer meets hospitalization level need, and therefore it's 100% the county's responsibility, and this person is ready for us to release them. Those decisions are being made separately, and the minute the one decision is made that does not meet hospitalization, that shifts the burden to the counties financially, with the counties having no ability to impact the release. And so that's a challenge. And whether, like in a couple instances in Sherburne County, where the does not meet criteria falls on 5 p.m. on a Friday or 2 p.m. on a Saturday, and there's nobody at the county to even start the planning, or does not meet criteria is met during the regular work week, but yet somehow still the AMRTC placement folks are not ready to release the individual. And it's like hopping in the taxi cab, put the flag up, the meter's running. And quite frankly, in counties like Sherburne County, Representative Considine, an impact of $100,000 into our budget is a significant impact. I think of what we can do as far as full-time staffing, if we could plan on that much money going towards our community behavioral health program.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there somebody from DHS that may want to address this communication problem within their own hospital?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kitzberger. Please introduce yourself to the record.
Sure. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the legislative director for direct care and treatment at DHS, and I apologize. We were actually across the street meeting on this very same issue with the Senate authors. So would you mind just, Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, would you just mind rephrasing your question?
Representative Considine.
Well, the treatment team is saying they no longer meet criteria, and the discharge team seems to be caught flat-footed and doesn't have the paperwork ready for another week. Why can't they work together so when the person is discharged, the paperwork is ready to go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, when you say the discharge team, are you referring to the county discharge team?
The hospital team is saying they no longer meet criteria to be in the hospital, but when the county calls and says we'll pick them up, they say the discharge plan won't be ready for up to a week is what we've just been told. And then the county's on the hook for the entire cost, when it would appear that all they have to do is work together so it's the same time. That would cut significantly into these bills.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I caught a little bit of the interaction regarding the separation between our discharge planners, our social work staff, and then our utilization management staff. We're required by CMS to participate in the utilization management process along with that. So there are rare instances where those two teams will not be in alignment in terms of a patient discharge. I know that there are instances where there have been breakdowns in communication on both sides, and we do We do work internally to document those processes and ensure that when reviews are taking place that we have our records straight in terms of interaction with counties. You know, we are perfectly willing to continue to work on that. Our internal process as well as how we engage in counties throughout that process. And we're if I might add, Mr. Chair, another one of our CMS requirements is that we're to begin working on discharge on the day of admission of a patient to MRTC.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just jump in really quick, I want to be really upfront and give a lot of credit to Mr. Kitzberg and Assistant Commissioner Underwood. We've been in negotiations on 3201 and 3323 over the last several weeks. The administration's been working very diligently with myself, with the Senate authors, right? You just weren't with the county. And so we unfortunately don't have an amendment language ready for today for the hearing for either 3201 or 3323, but we expect that we will have some compromise language ironed out in time for the chair's bill. I think one of the things that both testifiers have mentioned and then Mr. Kitzberg alluded to about the idea that sometimes there might be off in rare instances. One of the biggest things that the stakeholders have identified is the lack of an ability of the counties to appeal the charges. Right now, as soon as the does not meet criteria goes into place, that timer goes, and there's no way to walk that back within state law. And so even passing an appeals process similar to what's being used when there's disputes among counties over whose share it is to cover costs, there's already an appeals process for that type of dispute. To implement an appeals process in this setting seems like it would go a long way in resolving that. That's one of the things we're negotiating with the administration on. I appreciate your support, Representative Considine, but know that I feel personally like we've made great progress in the last few days.
Mr. Chair, I would just echo that. The stakeholders have done a really excellent job in communicating with us and attempting to mitigate our concerns as well.
Thank you, and thanks for coming down. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kitzberg.
Does anyone else want to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zerwas, you are doing a lot of work on a number of proposals, which I appreciate. And I know in the next week or so we're probably going to see the chair's bill. And it is possible, I imagine, that the compromise language that you are working on these different provisions, including the one last night, will just be in the bill. And so if that is the case, then you're not going to offer amendments to this language. I would hope that when we're in committee, you'll, help us see where that language is and just draw it out for us so we have a sense of where you've headed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, members, absolutely. And I, as we get language put together, I will be certainly make a point to share that with you as soon as I have kind of the final agreement. I'll absolutely do that.
All right. Thank you. And with that, Representative Zerwas renews his motion. House File 3201 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and thank you to the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House File 3323. Be held over for possible inclusion. It's the same exact discussion, Mr. Chair, and so I think we've covered it.
All right. Does anyone want to testify on this bill from the audience? None signed up. Seeing none. Member questions?
We're not going to offer the
A1. You're not going to do the
A1? We're not going to offer the A1.
All right. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not being a speed reader today. Could we just get a quick recap on what's the difference or if there's a difference? It sounds like there's a fair amount of similarities. please.
Okay. Yeah.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, what ended up occurring is prior to the legislative session, Sherburne County held a issue brief for elected officials in Sherburne County. In attendance at that issue brief was myself, other members, including two senators. Two senators took two cracks at trying to fix Sherburne County's problem, resulted in two jackets that got sent to me, which resulted in two bills that got submitted, which results in one grand compromise.
Thank you. All right. All right, House File 3323 is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Zerwas, you should have one more bill, 3542. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And only that one?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Till Monday, sir.
Representative Zerwas moves House File 3532 be laid over. We have the bill before us. There are no amendments. Representative Zerwas, can you explain? Please explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, members. This bill is to appropriate one-time $750,000 to the Community Action Partnership. For those who may not know, there are 24 Community Action agencies serving the entire state. Not all of them explicitly have the words Community Action as they're known in their communities. Some examples are the Southwest Minnesota Community Action Group, Lakes and Pines, and MVAC. My local community action agency is called TRICAP, which serves Sherburne, Benton, and Stearns County. I would now like to introduce to you the executive director of TRICAP and my friend Lori Schultz, who will provide a brief overview of the mission of TRICAP and the community action agencies with respect to the committee's time.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schultz. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lori Schultz. I'm the executive director of TRICAP in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today. I would like to share some examples of how TRICAP utilizes community action funding to help meet the needs of low-income people, low- to moderate-income people in central Minnesota. As Representative Zerwas stated, we are one of 24 community action agencies across the state of Minnesota. And while we're very similar to our partner community action agencies, we're different because we are geared towards creating and sustaining programs and services in our area to meet the needs that are specific to our locality. And so for TRICAP, each year we do a comprehensive community needs assessment. And that is where we take an in-depth look. We talk to our partners, our county social service organizations, people that are experiencing poverty in their lives, about what are the barriers to being able to be self-sufficient. And from there, what we look at is strategies and how we can address those needs. And that's where the community action funds come into play. So I want to share about two examples that TRICAP has done with our community action funds over the course of the last couple of years to help people move out of poverty, increase their self-reliance, and have healthy families and households. The first one is, based on our community needs assessment, the second highest need that we found in central Minnesota was a lack of transportation. And when I talk about transportation, I mean all facets of transportation, from public transportation to a volunteer driver program to car repair assistance to owning a vehicle. And so there are many people who need to be able to get to work, get to those vital medical appointments, appointments for their children, and just everything that we have in our lives in terms of meeting our basic needs. And so what we established was a comprehensive plan working with multiple different collaborators within our community to develop an innovative approach that involves car repair assistance, a donated car program, a lease-to-own purchase program, car care clinic Saturdays, where we have local community members working on cars for people, car mechanic classes that teach people who may not know a great deal about when do you need to change your oil, what should you be looking for if your car light comes on, those general maintenance to help preserve their vehicle, as well as financial education and literacy. And so a collaborative group of car mechanic shops, local auto dealers, the St. Cloud Technical and Community College, other service providers, we've all come together to develop this program. And with the seed money of Community Action, we have started a very beautiful process of being able to meet the needs of transportation when our public transportation system can't meet them. Based on that collaboration, people are getting to work. They are keeping their jobs. They are ensuring that they get to the medical appointments that they need to, and their quality of life has improved. Our second area of community action funds is TRICAP administers a tax assistance program. Last year, we served over 2,000 households in a three-county area, which brought back $3.5 million in tax refunds into the local community. From our community assessment, we found that we had a gap in having enough tax clinics based across the three county areas. In Sherburne County specifically, we did not have a tax assistance program. So there again, we collaborated with other organizations such as the United Way of Sherburne County, the YMCA, and Sherburne County Health and Human Services to come together to establish strategies on how we could overcome that. From that, we developed a new tax clinic at the YMCA, where TRICAP has over 40 volunteer tax preparers in a partnership with St. Cloud State University, where we use their accounting students who come in and prepare the taxes for, again, low to moderate income families. And through that partnership, again, we use community action funding to start that development. And then we sought other resources to pay for it. And so, again, it's another example of how community action funds can start something to help people become self-reliant. Through our tax program, not only are we helping people with their tax returns, we also have partnerships with local financial institutions that are there. Many of the people we serve are either unbanked or underbanked, and so they have the opportunity to meet with the local bankers and start that relationship and start a saving, a lifetime of savings. We have the philosophy, spend some, save some, and invest some. So it's more than just having your taxes prepared. So those are just a couple of examples of how TRICAP uses the very well-utilized community action funds.
Representative Zura, so it looks as if you've got a couple of other testifiers. Are they in support of, or would they like to
Mr. Chair, comments? I think at this point we're just here to answer any questions.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to the bill? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and go to member questions for the author or the testifier. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. We're in the second year of the biennium, so I just want to make sure, is the $750,000 ongoing per biennium or per year?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, members, it is to be appropriated for fiscal year 2019.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zerwas, as I'm looking at the description, it says it's intended to be an ongoing appropriation.
Mr. Chair, members, the way the bill is drafted currently, it's set to be an ongoing appropriation. We're going to see what we can get.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. So I guess when we see the bill come back to us, we'll figure out then if it is ongoing and if it is per biennium or per year. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members, as the chairman puts together his bill when he gets his budget targets and puts that together and sees what is potentially available for spending into the future. My gut tells me that's going to help determine if the chairman were inclined to include this in his bill. He's not here, so let's just assume it is something he wants to fund. Then I think it would be based on what his tails target for and all that. But that's something we would determine moving forward. But since the chair isn't in the room, I would assume this is something he'd want to fund, yeah.
Members, any further questions for the testifier or the author of the bill? Seeing none, Representative Zerwas, final thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, House File 3543 is laid over.
Thank you.
Is Representative Fenton here yet? All right. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's
really good to see you today.
It's nice to see you.
Been for a while. I'm feeling better.
I just want to congratulate Representative Zerwas on his efficiency, because clearly he made it through his bill so quickly that he beat the other members to the.
Representative Halverson, you know, he has been taking tutelage, and so, you know, it's an ongoing effort on our part to make sure that he's brief and that brevity becomes his friend.
You dropped as many bills as he has.
The Zerwas show has actually been a little light this year.
What's he up to?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Was Representative Franson asking for an encore? Are we like, so. Do we have other Zerwas bills
here? No, I don't think so.
Just saying his bill hearings have been a little light this year.
Compared to last year.
All right. Members, we've got a pinch hitter that's coming to the plate on the House File 2178. And as Representative Heinsohn makes his way to the testifier table.
Do I have a testifier?
Yes. He does. I'll move House File 2178 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, Representative Heinsohn, once you settle in, along with your testifiers, if you could introduce your bill, and I'm sure that you'll quite quickly want to introduce your testifiers in
yes,
order
I
to
will,
make sure
fact.
That the bill gets proper vetting. So with that,
well, I have
Representative
I have served.
Heinsohn, I'm also going to move the A1 amendment. Heinsohn moves the A1 amendment. Would you like to speak to the amendment?
You know, I will pass on that. Right. We like the amendment.
Members, as you look at the amendment, what it does is it basically just amends the year for the bill from 2017 to 2018. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Heinsohn, to your bill as amended.
Yes, but I will, as you suggested, turn the testimony portion
You're taking
portion
too much time already.
Your Honor.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, this bill is simply a follow-up on a bill that was passed in 2013. I see people on both sides of the tables here that are familiar with doula care, so I won't go into it, but I will answer your questions. This is Not Debbie Prudhomme, as I said, may say was going to be with you. This is Claire Sharp, and she is the director of the AHAVA doula program in Hennepin County. This bill wants to make doula care sustainable for Medicaid providers while still saving dollars for the taxpayers. You have on the second page of your handout the executive summary of the cost-effectiveness study done by researchers at the U of M and Mayo Clinic that indicates an even higher rate of reimbursement than we are actually requesting would still demonstrate savings to the Medicaid program due to the outcomes, the positive outcomes that are associated. We're proud to have the concurrence of the Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists as well as the Certified Nurse Midwives in support of this particular bill. They've been supporting us as part of the team for maternity care for many years now. And so basically we just want to get more doulas working and make it more possible for more doulas to work throughout the state. You can see on the very back page of your handout that we have doulas pretty much in every corner of the state, some of whom are traveling 50 miles around each way to serve their clients, but they're out there doing the job. We would like to make this service available to more people, especially those who need it, because the more doulas who are serving, the more Medicaid clients, the more money that is saved in Medicaid. That's the important thing, I think, to recognize, along with, I know you agree that the care is better. So it's a preventative service, and we urge you to pass this bill so that we can expand in all communities around the state. We welcome any questions any of you have. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Liebler.
Thank you. Thank you. To the testifier, just we were discussing, I think, last night, what proportion of births in the state are Medicaid. Do you happen to know that? It's some very large percentage, right?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Representative, it floats around half, and the number floats around 40,000. At this point in time, in terms of Medicaid clients being served, it's probably under 1,000. So we have a long way to go, and we don't expect this to pop up into a huge number immediately. It will be a gradual increase. But there's a very large population and a very large savings, therefore, that we can move towards.
So, Representative.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question for Representative Heinzman. First, I'll give him the softball question, and I'll give him the harder question.
Representative Liebler.
Thank you,
with
Mr.
trepidation.
Representative Heinzman, I assume that you've been around a few births in your time. Have you ever been around when a doula's been helping out with a birth?
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And although I have not experienced that specifically, I, as many of you know, have delivered 3 of our 6 children. So I have an idea.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, and I'll give you the harder question, which is not so closely related. Since you took on the tough duty of sitting up there at the front, if we were to pass this bill and do this reimbursement for doulas, do we have any way of ensuring that our Medicaid or medical assistance patients who are getting their care through managed care will actually get the service?
Representative Heinzman,
or
to the testifier.
Thank you, Representative.
Right now we have the organization that both AHAVA and our other testifier, Debbie, was here to talk about, Mr. Chair and Representative. We have contracts with all of the managed care organizations, and we've really recently met with some staff members from the Council of Care Organizations, and they've been very helpful. We have no reason to anticipate there will be any problems with this. They are we're working well together now. We've worked out a lot of kinks in billing over the last 2 years. So we have no reason to believe that this will not continue.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and just thank you very much for that. And, just to say that looking at the fiscal note, it says $7,000 in fiscal 2019. It goes up to $19,000 in 2020, $23,000 in 2021. That seems really a pretty good deal to me, and I hope that we can fund this. I think this is really worth doing. And, You know, if you save a few cesarean sections, you've paid for it. So I think it's a great thing.
Any other questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And building off that, I mean, it's actually pretty clear from the research that this will absolutely save more money than we spend. I mean, like, just by far. If you look at the material we have, the odds of a non-indicated C-section, cesarean birth, are lowered by 80 to 90% when doulas are present. So just incredible savings. And I want to point out the study that came from, the lead author was Katie Cozumaniel, who testified last night in support of the bill to close prenatal disparities. So this is just another way at that same goal, because the use of doulas and kind of culturally indicated doulas who fit whatever the mother's needs are, helps to reduce those disparities and save money, and the best thing, get a kid off to a really good start. So this is great. So, Representative Heisman, thank you for your leadership in bringing this forward. And I'm happy to be on the bill after you. It's really good stuff. Thank you.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm glad to see this bill, but the reimbursement rate, even if this bill's passed, is still pretty low because their costs are around $1,500 to provide the services, and that's what they would bill a private out-of-pocket person. The other issue that we need to address is making sure that people who have private insurance can also use private insurance to get reimbursed for these services, so we can save money in that market as well.
Any other questions from the members? Is there anyone in the audience wish to testify on behalf of the bill? Seeing none, Representative Heinzman, final thoughts on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the bill, albeit briefly. Thank you.
And with that, members, House File 2653, excuse me, 2178 is as amended. Representative Fenton. I'll move House File 2653 before the committee. Welcome to the committee, Representative Fenton. There are no amendments to the bill, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And House File 2653 is known as the Vivian Act. This bill is named for the beautiful young girl over there in the red. We'll meet with the testimony here. But what this bill does is it requires the Commissioner of Health to provide information about and engage in outreach activities regarding congenital cytomegalovirus. It's otherwise known as CMV, and it's far more common than one would know, and it affects can affect when the pregnant mother can give it to their child through childbirth. And I'm a mother of three, and I had never heard of this before. But to talk more from an expertise standpoint, I have Dr. Mark Schleiss, who's an infectious disease doctor at the University of Minnesota Children's Hospital, and he's also a professor of pediatrics with the University of Minnesota, to talk about the details of the disease in the bill.
Dr. Schleiss, welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Fenton. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and speak to you today. My name is Mark Schleiss. I'm a professor of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I also hold the American Legion and Auxiliary Endowed Research Chair in Pediatric Infectious Diseases. And I've devoted the last 30-plus years of my career to studying this infection. I think the important message that I want to communicate to you is this: this is the common cause of birth defects that no one's ever heard of. We've seen so much publicity, and rightfully so, about Zika virus in the last couple of years, and what a human tragedy that's been and how devastating that's been to unborn babies in South America. But cytomegalovirus has a magnitude and scope that's far greater than Zika, not only in America, but really globally. It's estimated that in the United States, about one baby in 100 is born with CMV infection. And if you factor in that we have 4 million babies born in this country every year, that's about 40,000 infants with congenital CMV. I see some members of the panel have as much gray hair as I do and probably remember the German measles or rubella from another era. the German measles used to cause devastating permanent disability in babies in the United States, most notably deafness, cataracts, heart defects, and mental retardation. We solved that problem with a vaccine, but where there is no vaccine yet for CMV, it's one of the things my lab works on. But just to put it into perspective, the peak year of rubella or German measles in the United States in 1967, there were about 20,000 cases a year. So there's more CMV damaging babies in this country every year than even at the peak of the German measles. What the Vivian Act will do, and I think that in your packets you were provided with this little handout that had some information about the bill and some information about CMV. But upon enactment, this bill will work with the Minnesota Department of Health to provide up-to-date data, evidence-based information, and opportunities for knowledge for healthcare practitioners, for parents of young children, and for others who are generally interested in preventing disabilities during pregnancy. Any young mother knows about the importance of Down syndrome, neural tube defects, that you can take B vitamins to prevent fetal alcohol syndrome, which can be devastating to a baby. But women don't know about CMV, and yet it causes more damage to babies every year than all three of those ailments put together. So the goal of this legislation is not to dictate a standard of care, not to tell doctors how to practice or take care of their patients, but is to provide resources and information and knowledge that can help women identify sources of risk and, more than anything, make them aware of how important this infection is. There have been now over a dozen states across the United States that have either considered or are actively considering or have passed legislation about CMV. It's really a public health issue. And there are not unexpectedly, there's a lot of variation from one state legislature to another in how they're looking at this issue. But importantly, the Minnesota legislation, the Vivian Act, doesn't mandate screening. It doesn't mandate any testing. It's really provide knowledge and information. The other comment I would make, and then I'll stop and let the real experts about congenital CMV make some comments because they live with it every day. But I do want to just point out the remarkable cost-effectiveness of this kind of legislation. The average cost per child for a lifetime of care if they have disabilities due to congenital CMV can rapidly soar into the six-figure range. In Minnesota, we would estimate that it might be as much as $25 million per annum in terms of the lifetime cost of care for disabled children. If this legislation even prevented one case of congenital CMV, symptomatic congenital CMV, it would pay for itself quite dramatically, and I think it will have a bigger impact than that. I think the knowledge and information that will be available to women and practitioners will be invaluable and an enormous resource for families in Minnesota. So those were the comments I wanted to make to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Schleiss. Representative Penton, I understand you might have another testifier.
I have Leah Hendrickson, and this is Vivian's mother.
Welcome to the committee. If you could introduce yourself and
provide
your remarks. Hi.
Thank you for having me. Leah Hendrickson. And like Kelly and Mark shared, I'm here as a mom asking for your support of the Vivian Act. In order to do that, I'd like to introduce you to my little sweetheart over here in red, Vivian Hendrickson, and my husband, Matt. And Vivian's really the inspiration for this bill that will ultimately represent so many. And Vivian is 4 years old. She loves My Little Ponies. She loves Scooby-Doo. And she loves singing Stevie Wonder songs at the top of her lungs. And she's doing great. But Vivian was also born with CMV. And life for Vivian on a day-to-day basis is hard. Vivi, like many other families that live with CMV, we have a life of doctor appointments, therapy appointments. She's had many surgeries on her ears and her eyes and many more to come, including one that she will have this fall where they will remove part of her spine to try to help her high tone and muscles. And so she won't have as many lifelong issues with her cerebral palsy. that was caused from her brain damage and being deaf in one ear. So as great as Vivian is doing today, really I attribute that to early intervention. So we were really lucky. We're still really lucky. We found out after Vivian failed her first hearing test, which CMV causes hearing loss, and that's one early indicator to look for CMV, which unfortunately many healthcare providers are not familiar with. Surprisingly enough, my doctor knew about CMV, which is actually pretty rare. And he said, you know what, this doesn't look right. I had studied CMV in his internship to become a doctor, and he'd had her tested. She did, in fact, have CMV, and we started antivirals immediately. She had physical therapy at 1 week old. She still has many, many therapy appointments. And she had her first hearing aid when she was a year old. She had her first set of braces when she was just over that. And we really do feel lucky. But the reality is many mothers do not know what this is. Fewer than 20% of expecting mothers have ever heard of CMV. Without that education, they can't have the dialogue that they need to have with their healthcare providers to say, I want to learn more about CMV and I'd like to be tested. You can't treat what you don't know. So our goal with the Vivian Act is to bring awareness to this, bring much-needed communication to healthcare providers and expecting mothers. And so we, you know, can merely make a difference in your communities. And your constituents are impacted by CMV. They're impacted by this all more common. Like Dr. Slice said, it's more common than fetal alcohol syndrome, Down syndrome, and neural tube defects combined. So this is really important, and I thank you for your time.
I see you might have one more testifier, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I'd like to introduce you to Abby Stachowiak.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Abby Stachowiak Hagstrom, and I'm here today with my family, my husband, Zach, my son, Max, and my two-year-old, Cody. Cody was also born with CMV, and I would like to share with you a little bit about what we've been through over the last couple of years. it's been a long couple of years, but, you know, I think what our family has in common with so many other families is that there has been this common thread where most of the families, or the, you know, the mother and the child, their healthcare providers, weren't aware, they didn't have the education that they needed about CMV to be able to intervene. When my husband and I look back at our story, my pregnancy, and the first few terrifying weeks with my sick child, there were so many places where we could have had intervention, and we didn't. And we live with that every day. My son Cody was born, you know, with a seemingly healthy pregnancy. I had a C-section term at 40 weeks, a repeat C-section, and he failed his newborn hearing screen 3 times. And I was assured, don't worry. I mean, you'll have to have follow-up, but you don't need to worry. You had a cesarean section. He's got fluid in his ears. So I wasn't worried about his ears, but I was very worried about my baby. When we took him home, he either slept, ate, or screamed in pain. It was some of the scariest few weeks of my life because I knew something was wrong. My husband and I reached out to our healthcare providers who were so good and they wanted to help us. We still see them. They're amazing. But they didn't have the education. CMV was not top of mind. So flash forward, we did get a diagnosis because we eventually were able to get in to see the audiologist, and my son was confirmed that he is just about deaf in his left ear. And so that, of course, started a barrage of tests. One of them was a very simple, you know, relatively non-invasive and inexpensive urine test that he came back positive for CMV. At that point, we were able to get him on antivirals, thank God, and he stopped screaming in pain every day. It was horrifying going into your health care provider, and they want to help you, but they don't know what's wrong with your son. And I remember saying to my husband, something's wrong. No one will help me. Things could have been so different if we possibly got Cody on therapy sooner. So flash forward, he's the strongest person I've ever known in my life. He's only 2. He shouldn't have to be that strong. He's got at least 6 therapy appointments every single week. He's got 9 specialists. He's deaf in his left ear. He's got brain damage that will never go away. As a result, he's got cerebral palsy. And what that means to us is Cody's 2 years and 4 months, and he cannot stand on his own. He's working so hard, and he will get there. But he struggles so hard. He can't walk. He can't chase his brother, Max. He cannot safely eat solid foods at this point. We're still struggling with that. Cody, for the first time, he told me just a couple days ago that he loves me. Like this. He can't say the words. He's nonverbal. And my husband and I are so painfully aware of the fact that had I been aware, are any of my healthcare providers, dozens of nurses we saw, nurse practitioners, physicians, if any of them had seemed to be top of mind, things could have been so different for our family and for Cody. So we can't change for Cody, but we can do this for other babies. There's no reason that any baby should have to go through this when it's so common and preventable and treatable. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the Vivian Bill? Seeing none, we'll close that and open it up to member questions. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the moms who came to testify and who brought this bill forward. We like to reassure you that there's always a lot of tears in this committee. You're in super good company. The Kleenex box was empty for a reason. So, so I want you to just know that, and we really are grateful when people are willing to bring some of the most painful pieces of their lives to us so that we can learn and try to make things better for other people. That's a real warrior spirit that moms bring, I think, to the Capitol. So thanks. Also want to just say thanks, Vivian and Cody. I got to say, I was watching them while you moms were testifying, and I'm kind of choked up. And they're so proud of you. And Cody's a little worried, was a little worried about that you were sad. I could just see it. And so way to go. They're proud of you. They're proud of themselves for being advocates. So thanks. Awareness is important, obviously, and I'm a co-author on the bill, so thanks, Representative Fenton, for your leadership on this. And I actually just have more of a question than maybe, very briefly, because I think it's outside the scope of the bill, but I'm very curious about what preventative measures we can take, how prevention plays in for families. And clearly part of the education is to help with prevention. Thank you for letting them come up to the table. This is great. And I just would like to hear more a little bit about the science aspect of it.
Yeah, thank you for that question, because that's the key. It's important to be aware and for these stories to be brought out. But will this make a difference, and why? And so the answer is yes. I mean, there actually are data. And so I've got a nice link on this information sheet to a study that just asked a very simple question. Does counseling and providing information make a difference for young women? And the answer is it does. There are a lot of CMV is hard to catch. You don't catch CMV by waiting in the checkout line at Cub Food like influenza. You have to have an exchange of body fluids. Well, that happens all the time with toddlers. They aren't potty trained. You have to wipe the drool off their nose. I mean, I have four kids myself. They're all grown up now, thank goodness. But I remember those days. And, you know, sharing a drinking or eating utensil, having a bite of a cookie that your toddler hasn't finished, kissing your baby on the mouth, forgetting to wash your hands after you've changed a wet diaper. Those are the kinds of exposures that we need to educate about, because that's how you get CMV. CMV is a disease of health disparities. It disproportionately affects children of color. It is an infection that is uniquely high risk in women who have exposures to lots of diapers and lots of saliva, child care workers. Moms who have children, particularly children that are in group daycare that aren't potty trained, are at high risk. I see these families all the time in my clinical practice. I'm a clinician in addition to a researcher. Time and time again, I hear the same thing. I've never heard of this before it happened to me and my family. So the key point is that these interventions do work. They do prevent infection, and I would direct you to this manuscript. There are others. I'm also part of a national working group with the CDC, and they are updating their guidelines on prevention as well. It's a big message that's going to be put forth on the national level. But we have a long way to go. We did a study at the State Fair. The graduate student who did that work is here at the hearing today, as a matter of fact, and surveying women about common complications of pregnancy, high-risk situations that might put your unborn baby at risk. CMV was last on the list. People have not heard about it. When you have educational resources and interventions that can make a difference, not only for the mom, but for the baby, as we heard from Abby, it really becomes a very compelling intervention.
Follow-up, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that information. Just wanted to invite Vivian for a Stevie Wonder dance party whenever. So thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you. Actually, Doctor, you want to grab a chair so you don't have to sit on your knees? I'm sensitive to that knee thing. Is there a test? I mean, could you routinely give women a test in their eighth or ninth month of pregnancy to see if they are carrying it?
Dr. Schleiss.
Yeah, thank you for that question. That is controversial, whether or not that would be an intervention that would be effective, and I'll tell you why. The answer is that women who have high-risk exposures or frequent exposures to infectious body secretions can actually get new infections with CMV, even if they've already had one earlier in their lifetime. So the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology, ACOG, as we call them, we work closely with them as pediatricians, their position is not to focus on testing, but to focus on education. And their monographs and literature emphasize education. Women might get a blood test and get a false sense of reassurance if they figure they're already positive. The key message is to be educated about those exposures. So I think that's why different states that have considered this around the United States have had different positions on testing. I think the Vivian Act is elegant in its simplicity, in a sense that it doesn't mandate any standard of care. It doesn't tell doctors how to practice medicine. It doesn't mandate any kind of testing, because I don't know that the science is there yet. But the science is there with respect to education and resource availability. So working with the MDH, that's why I think this could be very high impact. But the short answer to your question is there's no easy way to interpret those tests in pregnancy. Now, there are measures and research going on to test newborn babies at birth for CMV. That's not a part of this bill, but that is an exciting area of science that's moving forward in Minnesota.
Follow-up, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they did it on a routine basis, you could start the same day, though, with the antivirals and hopefully catch things immediately?
Yes. If you tested all newborn babies, and said, you know, this is a treatable condition. I want to know if a baby has it because I can begin treatment and intervention, then that would be logical, and I personally support it. Maybe we'll be sitting here 2 or 3 years from now talking about that. I don't know. But I think it's the science is premature to advocate for universal newborn screening. That's a whole different kind of dialogue and a whole different kind of bill, I think. This is really more about preventing the infection in the woman, and by educating her about sources of infection and exposures to avoid. But I like your idea of testing newborns. In fact, we're doing a research project at the U of M right now in my lab in conjunction with the Centers for Disease Control and the Minnesota Department of Health to try to validate and explore newborn screening in babies in Minnesota. But at this point, this is still research, whereas the Vivian Act, I think, is beyond research. I think we know that this intervention will help, and it's really now a public health implementation measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Schleiss, I have a question of note. If the problem instigates itself during the pregnancy, does the virus also present itself in the immune system or as an antibody in the mother?
So the answer is yes. Women, when they are infected with CMV, do make an antibody response. If they're already immune from their own childhood infection, they may boost that antibody response. The virus transmits to the baby and damages the baby, not always, but often, in spite of that immune response. This is one of the great scientific enigmas of CMV. Why does the virus transmit to the developing baby, even if the woman already has immunity? Other infectious diseases aren't like that. I mean, part of the reason that the Zika numbers are down so much in 2017 are that most of the women had already been bitten by the mosquito and they're already immune and their babies are protected. So we saw a lot less Zika in South America than we did in 2015, 2016. CMV is not like that. Even if you've got antibodies, the virus can still transmit. And the important point, once again, is not so much testing the mom, but teaching her about exposures that are high risk. Because even if she's got antibody, if she changes a wet diaper, finishes that cookie, drinks out of that glass that her toddler's been sharing, or if she works in group child care and is exposed all day long to infectious secretions, she needs to know about how to prevent getting a new infection and the risks if she happens to be pregnant. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for your work, and give my best regards to my good friend, Dr. Toler.
I will.
Any other questions for the testifiers or the author? Final words, Representative Fenton.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair and the members for your time today. And I think, knowledge is definitely power, and that's what this bill is about. And I want to thank Leah and Vivian for bringing this bill to us. So thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing this to the committee. With that, members, House File 2653 is laid over. Representative Fenton, you also have House File 501.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's an author's amendment, a DE.
I will move to take House File 501 off the table. Any discussion to that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion fails, and we have the bill before us. I will move the House File 501 be laid over. We have the bill before us. Understand that there is a DE2 amendment, which is an author's amendment. I will move that DE2 amendment. Representative Duncan, for your amendment.
Thank you. So this amendment only deals with the voice response suicide prevention and the mental health crisis response program. So if you remember last time in this committee, we have two components, the text for life and the voice response. So we are so appreciative for the funding for the text for life, but there is a huge critical need for funding for the voice response, suicide prevention, and mental health. And this just designates $969,000 in the fiscal year 2019 to the general fund for the Commissioner of Health to grant to a Minnesota nonprofit organization. Here we have with us is Matt Eastman from the Canvas Health. But I do want to just say, in my own county where I live, this week there were two suicides that happened with the new St. Croix Bridge. And I hope everybody's had the opportunity to also walk across outside to the Capitol to see how suicide affects our military and how from the beginning of the week to now the numbers of the shoes are up there on the Capitol and how that's been growing. This is a huge need, and I'm proud to sponsor this for our people at Canvas Health.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Eastwood. If you could announce yourself and present your testimony to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Matt Eastwood. I'm the chief executive for Canvas Health, a community mental health center that is headquartered in Oakdale, Minnesota. Canvas Health also owns and operates Crisis Connection. Crisis Connection is a crisis counseling call center that's been in existence since 1969. Crisis Connection is also the sole provider for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline for the state of Minnesota. Thank you for holding this hearing today about this important bill, which, if adopted, would allow the life-saving services that are provided by Crisis Connection to continue. Over the course of the past 50 years, Crisis Connection has become an integral part of the mental health and chemical health safety net system in Minnesota. However, as a community mental health center, we can no longer afford to operate this important service without sustainable funding. The DE2 amendment under consideration before you really originates in part from a discussion with legislators that our original request for $1,386,000 or 25 cents per resident of Minnesota per year was too costly. And so we have lowered that to $969,000 or 17 cents per resident of Minnesota per year. Under this more prudent approach, we would continue to operate as we are, utilizing professional staff and trained volunteers. We would also need to continue to try to enact minor contracts for specialized crisis services, and we would certainly have to continue to fundraise from private donors and foundations in order to keep the call center open. What we can do with $969,000 is that we can answer 85% of those 52,000, or this year it's trending toward 55,000 crisis calls that come into the center each year. We would continue to be the National Suicide, or be a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline provider for the state of Minnesota. We would continue to manage calls away from 911 and hospital emergency departments unless that's the level of care that they really need. And we would continue to be the after-hours, weekend, and holiday backup for over 800 mental health provider groups, state agencies, county and local governments, who all list this on their websites and on their answering services. Mr. Chair and members, we know that Crisis Connection saves lives every day. Operating a single certified crisis call center that serves all of the residents of Minnesota is the most efficient and accountable method of using those limited resources. I urge your support of this amendment and this bill, not only as the chief executive of this organization, but also as a concerned community member who has lost three family members and friends to suicide. Thank you for this opportunity to come before you and for your consideration. This concludes my testimony. I'm certainly willing to stand for questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Eastwood. Questions for the testifier or the author to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the DE2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just want to thank you for your time. And I actually got to tour the Crisis Connection where an active call was going on and got to see the hard and difficult work that they do, and I just urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify to the bill? Hearing none, we'll close that and open it up to member questions for the author or to the testifier. Seeing none, Representative Fenton, last word.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. With that, members, House File 501 is, as amended, is laid over. Members, we've concluded our business today. I would remind you that we are intending to meet Monday after session adjourns. We have 20-plus bills that we have to process on Monday. So please watch your emails for further information. Thank you for your time today, and we'll look forward to next week. With that, we are adjourned.